Welcome to Swim Streams Podcast. This podcast is hosted by Krish Subramanian, founder and chief research advisor at Risha.Research. Krish will talk to developers and other engineers about distributed applications and how they are using Swim platform to build their applications. This podcast is sponsored by Swim, a platform to build massively real-time streaming applications. Let us now move on to today's episode.
This is the first episode of Season 2 of Swim Streams Podcast. In this episode, I am talking to James Urquhart. James is a very good friend of mine and is the original Cloud Ratty, a group of people advocating cloud computing. He is very much into distributed computing, and I have had a lot of discussions with James about distributed computing and how it is reshaping the IT landscape. Today, we are going to talk about the next iteration of where distributed computing is going. James, can you introduce yourself and talk about what you're doing?
So my name is James Urquhart. I am on the Global Field CTO team at Pivotal, now part of VMware. So I'm a Global CTO at VMware. Our role is to work closely with our enterprise customers and the senior leadership at those customers. Typically at the CTO and CIO level, to develop strategies that help them transform to modern application development approaches. And my background is 30 years of working in distributed systems in one way or another. Most of my focus for the last probably 15 years has been on that intersection between when app development is complete and up to where it's being operated on a regular basis and being operated at scale to meet demands for the enterprise. And then the constant iteration of that, right? So all of the DevOps stuff, all of the day two operations, SRE stuff, all of that kind of stuff has been a part of what I've done. And of course I wrote a blog, which is how I met you, kind of in the early part of the 2010s. Called The Wisdom of Clouds. It was on CNET for a while and on GigOM. And through that, that's where a fair number of people know a little bit about me. But I was, I was definitely somebody who saw the value of cloud relatively early on and took a significant amount of my time to kind of write about that, explore it, and learn myself through writing.
Let's now set some context. When cloud computing came into existence, you talked about how cloud computing is nothing but a new operational model of how we have been handling systems. Now, edge computing and IoT is slowly permeating into the IT landscape. Along with cloud, it is forming the newer generation of IT systems. How does it change IT operations? Is it a new paradigm, or it is just extension of what we have been doing with cloud services? Can you talk a little bit about it?
To me, the linchpin in the center of this change that's happening now, that includes the value of the edge and includes the changes to operations that we're going to see be pretty dramatic over the next 10 years, is stream processing. So that includes the IoT form of stream processing that we all know, sensors and receiving that information and processing and understanding what's going on that way. But more and more, what you're seeing is other systems in the enterprise of various industries becoming those core stream sources. So a great example of that is that DevOps Enterprise, there was a great presentation from a gentleman who until recently was a part of Jet and Walmart, Jet.com and Walmart, who talked about the effect of stream processing on real-time inventory in the Walmart systems. Dramatic difference. The biggest difference being that because they don't have to do all these round-trip calls through multiple layers of services to get at real-time inventory, but instead are just calling a table that has received all the events over time, the cost of building and maintaining these systems significantly lower. Because if you're trying to maintain an SLA of a stack of stuff, you've got to do all the math that adds up everything in the stack to make sure you get the SLA you want at the top. With the real-time inventory stuff, you have a table, it's receiving or a service that is receiving the events. And then you just quickly query that. And the only SLA is that call to that table. You may have somewhat inconsistent information from time to time if you have failures, but good stream processing systems adjust for that. From the customer's perspective, they are not going to have an outage situation. They're going to have a situation where you may say, hey, you know, we know we have this amount of inventory. We're not sure about if we have other inventory over here, whatever it may be. So that cost, that lowered cost of handling real-time information at scale is, I think, the paradigm shift. And Edge is really, really important to this. Edge is very important in that a lot of that real-time processing shouldn't have to come all the way back to back-end systems in order to be made valuable. So one of the things that Swim does incredibly well, Swim.ai does incredibly well, is it creates a platform in which localized learning and decision making can happen within a smaller subsystem, right? In terms of a group of digital twins that should be interacting and learning from each other and building within a scope. And I think that kind of a model, similar things in different places about the idea of sort of localizing interactions that have to be real time, and localizing decision making and learning that has to be real time at the edge is critical. And also aggregating data. And we'll talk, I'm sure, in a little bit while about sort of how I see these systems organizing over time. But you know, part of that is it's quite possible that there's a limit to the amount of data that you can send for each leg, each hop that data goes through from the outside edge to the center and back out again. So if that's true, you're going to have to do some processing that lets you aggregate some aspects of the data at some point, depending on the volume of data. Most companies may not run into this. Few very large scale IoT applications are definitely going to run into this and are going to have to deal with that eventuality. So operationally, what does it mean? The new operations model is really one of moving away from the client-server model, finally, to more of a, I think the term that Christian Riley, his CTO at Citrix, used is brilliant for this, a micro-clustering model, right? So a model in which you have small clusters of systems that each have their nodes of activity that have some interaction with each other that then interact at some other scale with a slightly larger cluster interacted with the more central clusters that are kind of the heart and soul of the business or the heart and soul of the internet even, right? So that idea that we now have to be, it's not just data center and laptop anymore, right? It is now multiple data centers, multiple types of data centers, multiple types of networks, and beginning to have some specialization of the way systems come together. The cloud can help drive that, because it can take the operational burden off of the enterprise and put it in the cloud provider's hands. But that model of beginning to break things down that way, I think is gonna be the fundamental shift. And it's gonna drive more use of public cloud. And it's also, because of that operational model burden, it's also gonna allow, along with something that I'll talk about a little bit later, it's gonna allow for the outsourcing of commodity activities in business processes, make that easier to do. So there's a combination of things that have to happen there, but this shift in operational model is part of what will enable that.
That is a good point. With so many microclusters coming into picture and with so many diverse set of devices coming into play, do you see complexity creeping into IT operations? And can we tackle this complexity with some level of autonomy in operations? For example, autonomic computing has been a buzzword that has been in the industry for quite some time, but it has been abused, so it doesn't really made any sense to us. But with declarative approach to operations now promoted by Terraform, Kubernetes, etc., and use of machine learning and artificial intelligence on observability data, I see a marriage between the AI ops and this, and we can bring in some level of autonomy to IT operations. Do you expect it to happen?
No, I don't. I just said I think this morning on Twitter about the concept of GitOps, in which developers check in, you know, descriptions of how their systems should operate, and you know, the descriptions of the operational state of the system as a part of what they check in with their application code prior to deployment. And I don't see how you do the kind of scale we're talking about unless you have that kind of tight coordination between build, deploy, and operate, at least for now, at least until we learn a whole bunch of things about what's commodity and standard there. So I absolutely believe that declarative state for operational state is, I mean, you know, God bless Mark Burgess, way ahead of his time, right? Absolutely right on the button. But being able to declare the state that you want the system to be in and have the underlying operational automation be able to react to different situations that affect that state and get things back to where they need to be, that kind of autonomy is required. You have to basically be able to push the button to say, okay, push out my latest build, and have that build go out and know that it's going to run according to the way that you described it, even as things fail around it. Another part of that that's interesting is this idea that James Governor has been talking about recently about progressive deployments, right? The idea that you don't have a deploy that goes from, you go from A to B. You actually always have sort of this rolling, shifting environment that can roll out to a small group of people, make sure things work, or a small group of sensor collectors or whatever, make sure things work, and then be able to build out. So I think, you know, it depends on scale a little bit, or the scale of system that you're dealing with, but I think you absolutely need a level of autonomy in the way that the system operates from the perspective, especially of day two, the idea that a system operator, an infrastructure person, should be doing anything more than delivering capacity and should have to know anything about the applications. That is already going by the wayside, but absolutely has to go by the wayside. An infrastructure operator can run Kubernetes. I totally believe that Kubernetes belongs in the infrastructure layer, but a lot of the pieces that are part of the Kubernetes ecosystem belong in a platform layer. And the reason for that is because it's the difference between a path to production for developers and day two operations for developers versus delivering capacity to support that mission. Autonomy is especially the more scale you get to, the more the autonomy is required. But I think that autonomy is less about an application specific application aware autonomy in which the application knows how to heal itself, and much more about the application being able to declare the state that it expects to be in, and the underlying platform and the underlying infrastructure in support of that platform maintains that level.
After talking about IT operations and how it changes with the IoT and the edge coming into picture, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about app development. With the more distributed kind of computing, I'm using the term more distributed kind of computing to differentiate it from the centralized cloud services model, do you expect the change in how applications are developed? If you do, can you talk a little bit about it?
In terms of development model, I think we're breaking down to fundamental units slowly but surely here. So the two pizza team, you know, you can argue the exact size, but a team that's no larger than a two pizza team, generally working on at the function level for a scope that is well contained in terms of a mission for the company. I think that model is about as much as you can break development down. It introduces problems that are going to slow breaking things down anymore. How do you coordinate across teams? How do you make sure architecture is consistent? How do you, you know, all those kinds of questions. So in terms of development model, I think we're beginning to see what I would believe is a somewhat final state of the way teams will organize. Now, what they do will change fundamentally, right? So as we commoditize more and more and push that down into the cloud operator layer, more and more development teams and enterprises and in startups are going to find themselves doing different activities than they do today. You know, the idea that you would be building your own container definitions and running Kubernetes as a development team and being on the pager for that, I think is a short-lived kind of window. That being said, though, architectures are an interesting question. So let's get a little bit into sort of, I mentioned a little bit about sort of scale, and there's a book by a gentleman that's part of the Santa Fe Institute, which is the big academic think tank around complex systems. Gentleman's name is Jeffrey West, and he wrote a book called Scale, and I highly recommend the book to everybody listening. Scale talks about how complex systems seem to consistently evolve into the same basic shapes based on the fact that that they grow and react to things based on power law kind of dynamics, right? So the shifts are not consistent and linear. They're not even generally simple exponential kind of shifts. They're shifts that are represented by what happens as the effect of what is pulling to slow down the change comes into effect with what's trying to drive the change to happen. So some changes, they get the feedback loop that difference is positive towards the change side, and so things continue to grow like crazy, and you get a power law that means that you get a pretty massive level of growth. But most things actually grow to a point where that value starts to shift in the idea of slowing down growth, and then eventually maybe even plateauing a little bit. So good example of that is, if you look at why the human bodies is kind of in the size range that it is on our planet, like, well, why don't we have any blue whale sized human beings? And a large part that has to do with the way the mechanisms have evolved in our body. As you grow, certain things start to break down physiologically, even chemically, start to not work at too large a scale. So the body has sort of evolved in a way that it says it grows to a point where it senses where either evolution has driven us to, or the body begins to sense that it's reaching limits, and then it says, okay, it starts to adjust how it's growing and whether it grows. This relationship and these power laws and stuff results in some really interesting things. So one is the shape of complex systems becomes incredibly consistent. Like, not exactly consistent, but the general shape, you look at it and you go, wow, that's really the same. Like, consider the car transportation infrastructure, automobile transportation infrastructure versus the human body, right? The idea that there are arteries, right? We even use that term when we describe kind of the main surface roads. Freeways are the major blood vessels. You have arteries that are kind of larger things. Then you've got the surface, the individual neighborhood streets, individual surface streets that become a little bit more like the capillaries. They have lower traffic. They play an important role. And our bodies with our blood flow, the same thing. So complex systems in which things flow through the system tend to evolve in very similar ways. So if we look at IoT, and we look at these architectures that we're going to build, I think I can very easily predict that we're going to see a model in which we have these micro clusters and individual applications that play that sort of endpoint role. And you have some then kind of larger applications that collect that data and play some major role. Maybe they're a mission critical application for a division of a company, or even for a company as a whole, depending on the company. And then those systems will integrate with a larger kind of core sharing of information that happens. I think today that's, and I'm actually writing a book on this topic now for O'Reilly, that's really the point that's slowing us down right now, is we don't have a standard, well-known, out-of-the-box mechanism to connect to flows and reconnect flows easily and cheaply across that kind of central thing, which is the internet, which is us online on the internet, being able to connect. So I believe when that happens, which we're moving in that direction, there's a CNCF standards project that is a good stab in the right direction. I believe also the way products are beginning to be used, like Kafka, I talked about the Walmart real-time inventory thing. They have integrations with external companies as a part of that flow. The way that the stock market is changing today and the interfaces for doing high-speed trading and other forms of stock market interactions, there's some standardization starting to happen there. I believe we're going to start to see that more common way of being able to share information by streams. And when that happens, I guarantee you will see a massive amount of data that was too expensive to move between companies in real time begin to make that move. And you'll see experimentation on real-time data that didn't happen before. And you will see the generation of new value that we never expected on top of that streaming infrastructure. So this is a big moment. We're in the infancy stage and the pioneer stage in terms of how streaming will affect architecture in the long term. But as I look at it, I think I can fairly confidently say, if I look at the scale, I can make some predictions about what might be true in that environment. And one is that the central cloud is not going away, right? It's going to play a core role. Those large scale analytics systems, those large scale processing systems that play a role for many customers are going to be there for a long time. But I can also predict that probably you aren't going to send every piece of data from every single sensor you ever collect across the wire to every customer that wants it, because the system probably won't allow that kind of scale of movement. So there will be some aggregation or some value generation that kind of narrows the data. And then I think each connection between, you know, a microcluster and a sort of artery system and an artery system and a core trunk system, I think those are going to have common bandwidths of available number of events that can be handled per unit of time generally, or per unit of bandwidth anyway. So that's sort of the way I look at it. I think that's why I think the architectures will evolve the way they will. Development, as I say, is kind of reaching, I think, its end state. I could be wrong. Somebody could come up with some brilliant way of doing things that I never thought about. It could be that low code, no code changes things dramatically in ways that I never expected. It could be that automatic code generation finally gets to the point with AI, finally gets to the point that it changes things in ways that I never expected. But my guess is that those things will come into play, take over contextual, non-valuable stuff for developers, and developers will turn their value to creating new value on top of that we never imagined was possible.
I totally agree with you on the flow architecture and the fact that some of the real-time processing will happen at the edge, and other processing, especially processing of historical data, will happen with the cloud providers. I'm totally with you on this. Now, let's talk about the real-time streaming architectures, which is gaining a lot of traction among the developers. Do you expect a change in developer expectations, developer behavior, and how they approach these architectures? Or it is just the continuation of the same approach they had taken with distributed applications when they built for the cloud? Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I think flow is the key word. So you have to do things that don't stop the flow if you want to keep it real time, right? So you can't store things in a database and then go do analytics and then send the result out and call that real time. So this is what drives, I think, the real value in the serverless world today. So if you have an action that's to be done against a piece of data as it comes in, aggregation or a transformation or a calculation against that data, then I think I think these streaming processes will drive a lot of sort of that kind of functional level stuff at that level. I also think it's really interesting when you look at modeling and AI in terms of decision making. So when I think of process modeling, as per what we did in the, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, it was that graph that you had where you had, you know, you had edges running out, and then you'd hit a node that was a decision node, and it would split into two new edges, and it would go two new paths now. And so you think of that, like the decision-making points become really, really interesting, because there's two aspects of the decision-making that can benefit from some statistical analysis and or AI. So one is it a threshold to react to in some interesting way? So that, you know, you're looking for anomaly detection largely in that situation, something that's unusual, and the system can learn what's usual and what's unusual without humans having to track that and maintain that, at least on a day-by-day basis. And then the second part then is, what do I do? What do I do when I see this kind of anomaly? And so I think you'll see the anomaly detection stuff more first. But I do believe it'll get very interesting when you look at maybe some services that you can send signals to that can give you some feedback about what kind of decision needs to be made based on this data coming in. That may be fixed rules. It could be an AI model. It could be some statistical calculation. And so, you know, if you look at that, then you kind of think of it, that graph that I talked about drawing before. That graph may not stay within a company. It may bounce outside of a company for a single decision, come back in the company for some other part, and move forward. And so now you get into, okay, when I say real time, how real time do I mean, right? And because nothing's totally real time, but how much delay am I allowing? And you may have situations then where you need to be able to push models into your edge infrastructure and be able to have a third party say, okay, here's the model that we're selling that's had this success rate in terms of handling this situation. And so that creates a really interesting, you know, I think there's some business opportunities galore around this, because I think we've been so customer interacting with database, client server oriented for so long, even though we broke up the layers and the tiers and we did, and then serve microservices, right? We've been so getting customer calculation data oriented that this idea that flow is a big part of this, the movement of some propagation of some signal until it finally reaches its end state and is put to rest. That there's a huge amount that has not been done that supports that model. And that's what kind of gets me very excited about the next 10 years. I think we're going to see a radically different world in terms of what we do with signals as soon as they propagate from their source.
This is a good time to ask the usual question I ask almost all of my guests. Where do you see app development going in the next 5 to 10 years? What are the trends you foresee? And is it going to see dramatic shifts? I would love to have your thoughts on the outlook you have for the next decade.
As we talked about, smaller teams working on some microcluster kind of concept, connectivity. I think enterprise architecture becomes a really fascinating problem. It becomes a curation of a more biological looking entity than architecture of a building or a ship or whatever model you used for architecture in the past. That's why I begin to talk about, you know, enterprise curators or enterprise gardeners as being maybe a more correct term in that situation. But I think you still have these program level problems of how do we coordinate across all these different teams making their independent decisions and make sure we're building towards a consistent mechanism, right? What's the DNA we're feeding in, or what are the building codes that we're enforcing as these systems come together? So But I think so. I think that's one interesting area, is this a renewed look at the importance of enterprise architecture from the perspective of guidelines and guardrails as opposed to structure and scaffolding. And that's an interesting change to see come down the pike. I think some of the new languages are maybe better cut out for some of the things that we're seeing happening right now. So, you know, I'm hearing all kinds of positive things about Rust. You know, I think Java will be around for a long time. I think it can adapt well to whatever environment it finds itself in, assuming it's curated by a trustworthy curator. But to be real frank, I think, you know, the time is ripe for a new language. I'm not saying it's going to be Rust necessarily, but for a new language to begin to rise to the top. But it's going to have to be a language that's developed with flow in mind and developed with these kinds of processing aspects. The other thing is I'm paying attention to a couple of companies out there that are looking at creating a dial tone for these kinds of applications. So how much work is it going to be to integrate? And then if it's not a lot of work and it's actually really cheap to integrate, how does that change the way you look at what you should develop versus what you should just go ahead and go get something from somebody else as a part of your overall calculation? The idea, again, latency is the counter here, right? Latency is the thing that'll slow it down. But the idea that you can cheapen the development of sophisticated applications even further may mean that we see a lot of signals being propagated in a lot of interesting new ways that we never expected to a lot of companies that specialize in doing something for some industry or some decision point that's common in software development. That's really valuable. So, and APIs don't go away. You still have call and response situations. You still need call. I mean, stream processing doesn't replace, I think, anything other than the kind of API calls you might have been making to go retrieve a piece of data in real time. But other than that, the huge amount of call and response stuff, like UI interactions, I think will still largely be driven by API-like approaches. But you'll have a layer that then separates that out from the propagation of signals elsewhere. So I'd say that's the big things that I see. It's hard to predict too far in the future on this, but it is an opportunity. This is a moment like when cloud was introduced. This is a moment where fundamental change to the way applications are built and the way businesses are able to respond to customer needs. We're on the cusp of another 10-year run here.
James, you talked about your upcoming book. Before we wind down this podcast, can you tell our listeners what this book is about, when it will come to the bookstores? I think I am really excited about this book. I am pretty sure this is going to be yet another interesting book which I want to read. I would really love to hear from you about what the topic of the book, as well as what you are planning to cover in this book.
Not overjoyed, not super confident yet to announce the date. We're certainly targeting to try to get something out this fall. excuse me. The idea is to talk about flow and talk about specifically the heart of the book is about what happens. So integration is basically the core of integration is made up by interfaces and protocols. As long as interfaces and protocols remain consistent, what happens on either side of the wire doesn't matter, right? So if you get the interfaces and the protocols right, you can make integration incredibly cheap. So there's no guarantee that will happen, that it will converge on one thing. But my belief is that in this case, there's a lot of drivers to do so. So if you think of the way that HTTP drove a convergence of all linking of information in place, right? And activities based off of information or activities and including identity, right? So that's a lot of the interactive websites you go to are based on the fact that you are you and you're linking into information related to you or related to others related to you. So if you think about HTTP hot linked information, what I'm arguing is there's a flow, integration standard that will become somehow, some way. I can't tell you what it looks like. I can't tell you whether it'll be a standards body standard or a de facto that falls out of open source or what. But something will fall out that will basically say that we know, here's a URI. I want to connect to your stream. Here's your mechanisms to tell me whether or not, you know, what kind of volume I can expect, whether I'm authorized to or not. But it'll become very simple for you to say, hey, I want to begin to collect the payloads from that stream. And then maybe I need to go to your website to figure out how to read the payloads. But I'll know how to make the connections, and I'll know how to interpret the metadata about the events that are coming in. And stream, it can be raw streams too. It doesn't have to be events. So from that perspective, I'm writing a book about sort of what happens when that day comes. And part of it is where are we today? How can you use things like Wardley mapping and promise theory to get a picture of what things might look like, and why is this going to happen? Right. Is it almost certain to happen? And B, what can you get a picture of kind of the general shape of movement? And then I'll speculate a little bit. I'll speculate a little bit about the ways that various pieces that have to be there to make this work will happen, using, again, probably promise theory and some other approaches. But the idea is it's a book for manager, you know, for business people who use technology for and depend on real-time information, and for technologists who are looking at kind of where the future of these kinds of, and what Flow can do for them from a technology perspective, and just a little bit of a forward thinking book, trying to kind of predict what this 10-year revolution is going to look like.
Awesome. I really can't wait to get the book in my hands. Looking forward to it. Thank you very much, James. It was a great pleasure talking to you again in this podcast. Every time I talk to you, I'm brimming with ideas, and then I need to take some time, digest it, and sort of get back to normal. This was one such great conversation. Thank you very much.
And I always enjoy it, Christian, and all the best to you and your listeners, and it was very enjoyable. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Before I end the podcast, I really want to thank Swim.ai for supporting me in the Swim Streams podcast. The journey with the Swim Streams podcast really gave me many opportunities to talk to various people associated with building applications using distributed systems, especially real-time applications. I learned a lot from this, and I'm pretty sure the listeners also learned a lot from this. Thank you, Swim.ai, for helping us go on this journey together.